Hello, listeners. Hi, I'm Dr. Margaret Vaughn, and welcome to Getting Smarter, a podcast where I get to talk with some of the most transformational thinkers and leaders in the field of education, all in the hopes of getting smarter. Join me in listening and learning.
Welcome. Today on Getting Smarter, we have the famous and infamous Dr. Douglas Fisher, who is the professor and chair of educational leadership at San Diego State University. Dr. Fisher is a credentialed, excuse me, teacher and administrator in California. He has published over 250 books, chapters, and articles focused on school improvement and was elected into the Reading Hall of Fame in 2022. He's the past president of the International Reading Association and has won several awards for his research in the field, including the William S. Gray Citation of Merit and the Adolescent Literacy Thought Leader awarded by the International Literacy Association, as well as an exemplary leader by the National Council of Teachers of English. And he has so many awards. It's just many, well, those are just some of the many awards that he has received for his scholarship and his work in the field. And he is one of my favorite people to talk to. And welcome, welcome, Dr.
Thank
Fisher. It's so great
you.
to see you. Thank you for talking with us today.
Of course, and I appreciate the invitation.
Oh, you are just such a rock star and such a superhero to me. And it's really wonderful to have the opportunity to visit with you.
Thank you.
So, all right. So, well, before we get started, could you maybe share a little bit about why did you go into the field of education or in teaching?
So I'm one of the stereotypes. I am a product of teachers. And so I, from an early age, this was aspirational. Like, this is what people I love do. And I want to do that. And I want to be part of the stories that they tell and the conversations they have and the joy that they experience. So I knew from very young, this was where I wanted to be. This is where I wanted to spend my time. In college, I had little forays into other things. I got super interested in health. When I went into health education, I got super interested in how communication occurs. So I started studying communication and language development. And so I had all these forays, but I always knew that I would be teaching of some kind, professional development, teaching kids, teaching adults. I wasn't sure where, but I knew that that's the right match for me.
That's wonderful. So what grades did you teach? I know that you have so much experience.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about that?
I started off in early childhood. I was working with students with disabilities in the Child Find program at a preschool, I guess, early childhood education center, doing that, loving it, still going to school at the time, and started thinking about where I wanted to be. And at the time, this is hard to believe now, there were no jobs. They were hiring substitutes and long-term substitutes, but there were really no jobs. And so I got offered a job, half-time health, half-time English. And so not being credentialed in either, I said yes, because it's a job.
Right.
And so there I was, probably 22 years old, teaching health ed to 16-year-olds and having to like say all the words of family life and sexuality and all these things, and then teaching English. Again, neither credentialed in either area. And I was confronted with students having a hard time reading. And I went on a quest and I wanted to go back to school to figure out how I could help. What do I need to do to help students learn to read? What's really interesting, I'm flashing back as you asked me that question. In my college composition class as a freshman in college, I chose the topic of illiteracy. I still have this paper that I wrote. So this was 1983,
wow.
And I wrote my first college paper on illiteracy. And so I flash back, like, literacy has been something that's been on my mind for a really long time. And in this paper, I wrote that there was disproportionate literacy rates, that it was, you know, society doesn't value literacy for certain people. I mean, this is a long time ago. So it was fascinating to me. And so then I become a teacher and I'm like, they can't read and I'm not helping them. So I went back to school. I ended up meeting Jim Flood and Diane Lapp, who said, you should go do this degree with us, and, you know, on and on. And so I did, and I loved it. And I never aspired to be a faculty member or a writer or anything like that, but I was very happy with my new knowledge. I got the chance to co-teach. I was offered a 50-50 job, like position sharing, with this amazing teacher, and she was teaching kindergarten. And the deal at her school was that you went up each year. And so kindergarten, same kids, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. And we just hit it off. We had a great time. So that's my original goal was elementary. I got this job and then I went back to elementary. And then several years later, I was working on a project, like a professional development project. And some editors of a journal came by the school. So one of my colleagues, now colleague at San Diego State, I was not a professor or nothing, came by the school and said, "You're doing really interesting stuff on literacy." So I brought these people by, and they happened to edit the Journal of Adolescent and Adult Literacy.
Wow.
Yeah, long time ago. And they said, "You should write about this." And I'm like, okay.
That's crazy.
And so I wrote a short column, a short article, 7 literacy strategies that work, about our school. Of course, you couldn't use the name or anything, but I wrote it about our school and it got accepted. And when it first came out, the joy and the pride, it was incredible. Like something I thought about and I wrote about is now in paper, on print, and forever. And I remember now colleague Gay Ivy writing me an email telling me how much sense that made, how she appreciated it. So I'm like, "You're super famous. You know, I studied you in graduate school, and like you've got all these big articles and things, and you wrote me this lovely message." So I got reinforced early on from meeting these editors, from having a person at San Diego State say, "You should do this," to receiving an email from someone I respected in the adolescent world. So that's all the shaping of me.
Well, listeners, you may not know this, but Doug actually did the same for me. I don't know if you remember this, but we had a piece that came out, I think it was in The Reading Teacher. Mm-hmm. And I think it was before, I think I was introduced.
I didn't know you.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And you sent me a gracious, wonderful email that I actually printed off and I have. And it said, it was so kind. It was like, what a great article this was. And, you know, you focused on adaptive teaching and you made it so explicit. And I am just so touched that you, like someone else did that for you and you always pay it forward. And like, you had made such an impact on me. When I got that email, it was the same feeling. It was like, oh my gosh, like this really famous person took the time to write me this message, and I was just blown away. And so, oh, I love that Gay did that for you.
Yeah, she did. Oh yeah. And I remember writing to you. Yes. And I don't do that often. I mean, when articles strike me, I do take the time to write to someone because, you know, I might read 3 or 4 articles and like, yeah, those are good. Those are interesting. But every once in a while, it's like, that one made me think. And that one made me think differently than I thought before. Sometimes it's reinforcing and I'm like, yay, I love your article. But sometimes it makes me think differently. And I think that person deserves to know that there was an impact. This is lonely. I mean, you know, too.
Yeah.
Doing this work, like sitting in your little home office by yourself or going to school and collecting data and trying to make sense of what it all means, is a lonely thing.
Yeah. And you wonder, does it even matter?
Does anyone actually read this and do
anything? Yeah. And the fact that you did was like a giant, like, it was just so pivotal to me. So thank you. That was so amazing. So thanks. I love that your beginnings that's so fascinating that you were, you know, and they just happened to walk in and were like, "Hey, we're journal, you know, JAL editors, and we want to see what you're doing." And hey, oh my gosh. So hopefully you have that one first article. I mean,
I do.
You have it.
I do. So in the old days,
you have it framed.
In the old days, when you went to the conference, they had a booth and you could take a picture of yourself.
Oh.
And the background, it was a JAL. It was you could do Reading Teacher or JAL or whatever. But it was just this, like, you could do it. And then they would arrange it. Like, I put the title of the article on it because you could put whatever else you wanted.
So cool.
I still have it, like the picture of me in the fake cover of JAL with the title of the article. And there were some other titles. So I still have that.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that. I wish they would still do that.
I do too. It was great.
Yeah. What an empowering experience. Oh, I love that. Well, you know, one of the things that I love, love, love about your work is that it's always rooted in schools, you mm-hmm. know, and I think sometimes we in academia, right, we can get so far away from what's actually happening. And I love that your work is so rooted in the schools and There's nothing
you
about
can probably
it.
Hear the fire trucks or the ambulances coming now. So, because I'm at school, this is real. I'm at a high school right now where I work, and this is real. And so I appreciate you saying that. I love the energy of a school. I love the cycle of the year. You know, right now we're recording this and it's spring. We just finished spring break. We've been back for a week. The energy is now, it's the sprint to the finish, and we got to clear any incompletes. We got to do this, and testing's coming, and they're all nervous, and college admissions letters are out, and there's all of this emotion with college admissions. I love that energy. It's the cycle of my life is tied up with the school year.
I love that. Now, you are a principal.
No, not anymore.
Okay.
I was.
Okay. So
I call myself a teacher leader now.
Oh, nice.
We have a principal, but I like to do a lot of coaching and co-teaching. That keeps me happy. Yeah. So we have a principal who runs all the administrative, that kind of stuff.
That's
and he's
great.
Very good at it. He and his team is great. But Nancy and I have moved into more of coaching, supporting, guiding. Lots of student teachers are here too. I think we have 17 student teachers. So mentoring them and helping them figure out where they want to go next in their careers. So
I love that. What was it like to be a principal? I mean,
I was a co-principal because of the demands of our other jobs. So it's a great, I mean, you can maximize your impact. You know, you teach at, you know, in elementary school, 26 kids, a high school, maybe 200 kids, depending. But now we're talking 3,000 kids, or, you know, I mean, the impact, the potential for impact is great. And you have to stay connected. You have to stay grounded. You have to know where you're going. What's your vision? How do you bring people and listen to their perspectives and then keep the direction going? It's a fascinating role to play.
But even functionally, like, how did you actually do that and do all of this other amazing work in the field and also publish prolifically and you know, how did you do that?
I don't really know. I think people would say you don't have a thing that you're known for. That's a somewhat criticism of my career, Nancy's career, is like, maybe some people would say you're literacy, but then you also write about assessment and curriculum and leadership and scaffolding and all this stuff. I write about what's happening in school. So whether it's at our district level of here's what's happening, here's the things we're all talking about and struggling with and trying to figure out, or if at our school. So I write about that. And writing helps me clarify thinking. And so when I go and read other people's work, it's because I'm on a journey of me learning, and I learn best when I write. It forces me to confront my understanding, what I don't understand, where the gaps are. And then when I get sent out for people to review, that's when I realize, oh, my thinking is incomplete. I got to do some more work. Or this was actually really solid and the reviewers responded to it. So writing has always helped me clarify that thinking, clarify the direction we're going. And that's why I write about different things all the time, is because of whatever our school system or this particular school is working through, that's what we have to have.
I love that view of writing, because I think sometimes, you know, when you're assistant professor and associate professor, you may not see that that's the goal, right? Is to get smarter with your thinking and help you to kind of get perspective and also kind of get your ideas out. And so I love how that's just so eloquently put, like, it helps you with your thinking, and that's what you do. That's how you process what you're about. So I love that.
Yep.
But you are amazing. You know that. So I'm good at, like, this is.
So Nancy says, how do you write so fast? It drives her crazy.
Oh, really? And
so I am a very fast writer. I recognize
that. And I
bet
that. It's good. I bet, like, you know, you could write and it's like, the first draft, you know.
Well, I get it. There's a lot of revisions, but what I do is during my exercise, I'm processing and composing. So whether I'm in a spin class or I'm out running or whatever I'm doing, because I change it up because I get bored fast. Whenever I'm doing that kind of activity, I'm composing in my mind. And so when I sit down to a computer, I've already organized it. I've already know where I want to go. I already have an outline. I have scenarios, I have details. So when I go to sit, I'm not having to think about what I want to say. That has worked really well for me. Also having co-authors, and I almost only write with other people. I don't like to write alone. I love the energy of bouncing ideas off people and disagreeing. I love a healthy argument with Nancy about something. We're such close friends, and we're allowed to say, I don't agree with you on this. This is what I'm interpreting. This is how I'm thinking about this. This is where I think we need to go. And I believe we're both better for it. But I've written, I mean, I think Nancy's counted something around like, we have like 26 co-authors in the last 5 years, different people that we've written with. And that is, it's an honor that people want to write with us. And for people who are newer in the profession, to be able to say, let's collaborate, let's learn from each other, and to learn this aspect of the job of how you compose, how you organize your thinking and put it on the computer, and how that gets processed and revised. And that's, and people did that for me way back. So I finished a paper years and years ago, and Jim Flood, and some people will know Jim Flood. He died several years ago. But I turned in a paper, and he said to me, you don't even know you're a good writer, do you? And I have such a, no, cause I didn't, no one ever said that to me before. And so I have such a vivid memory of the first time someone told me I was a good writer. And it was someone that I highly respected. And Jim Flood's mind was amazing, and how he could hold it, you know, all this information and ideas. And for him to say that to me was like, it was so empowering. It was just so incredible.
Oh. I love that you're able to do that with people now too. It's so, you know, I know that you're continually doing that. You're so gracious in the work too. Like I love that about you and always your work. And it doesn't surprise me that you have 20, you know, 20 some odd co-authors, because you're just that gentleman. I love that. How about some highlights from your career? What stands out for you in addition to some of the things you've shared? Anything? What did you enjoy the most, and why? Did anything surprise you about your journey? Well,
so one of the things I'm most proud of, the things I've accomplished, one of the things I am most proud of is that 6 years ago, I opened a childcare center at our high school for our staff. And so I get to see babies. And so we take 6 weeks till kindergarten. So I got in touch with my early childhood roots again, having a preschool here. And it's an amazing service for the educators who work here to know their children are downstairs being taken care of and learning with colleagues that they co-work with. And so I am very, very proud of this. It was very difficult to get permission to have a childcare center on a high school campus. It was very difficult with licensing and regulations and staffing and all these things. But I am very proud of that, because new people coming into this profession, if you have little kids, childcare is highly expensive. And if we can offset that and have you feel safe so that you can learn and hone your craft, that's a huge service. I think it's a big part of our retention and recruitment, but it also is showing people you're valued, and you're valued because we're taking care of your children too. So that's probably like in my top five things I've ever accomplished in my life. That's was wonderful. Getting that opened and the service to our staff members, and high school students could have their children there too at our school. We don't have any current high schoolers who have babies, but they could have them there too. So, I'm very proud of that. I'm very, very proud of that. Other things I'm proud of, you know, I know this sounds funny or strange or whatever. Every time something comes out that I have written, I have this little moment of joy. Like someone wanted this. Someone thought this was a good idea. And it never gets old. And I believe every educator has at least one book in them. We collect so many stories and experiences, and we understand the evidence. It's just, do we have time to sit down and write those stories and revise them? Because it's not just one time, it's a process. But I think that's another joy I get.
I love that. Well, then you must be having a celebration like every other day, because as much as you write. So how about, does anything surprise, is that the thing that surprises you, that you find the joy in it? that you
I
did?
Guess so. The other surprise, you know, I keep thinking we're going to make more progress in our profession, and we keep like, we should, there's some of these conversations we shouldn't be having anymore. We know the answer to this. And grade level retention, I cannot believe we're back to making first graders repeat first grade. And the evidence is so strong. And yeah, I mean, there's some, you know, whatever, but like, we're going to wide scale. Here's an assessment. If you don't pass it, you have to repeat first grade or whatever, third grade, sixth grade. And it just, it feels like, where's the progress in our profession? And I think people are being demoralized right now. And it's really saddening me and frustrating for me. So that's kind of where the surprise is. I just kept feeling like we would make more progress than we have made. Yeah. And I think teachers do amazing work every single day, and they almost never take credit for it. And we need to acknowledge our efforts are making a difference. And we need to recognize that, yeah, there's a way to go, and yes, kids have unfinished learning, but boy, are we doing a good job. And the narrative is so negative around teaching right now. And how do we change that narrative? That's my surprise. Like, how did we become so vilified?
Yeah.
Like every profession is possible because of teachers.
Yeah.
And the American dream, I mean, like, we provide free education. And so that's kind of where I'm struggling with how beat up teachers are in the media and the press. And
yeah, I can really resonate with that. I just came out of my class, and I shared an article that was written in 2008 about the reading wars. And I was like, here we are again. I was like, and that's not even 2008 isn't even that old, but I can even date you back 20 years before that. And, you know, it's even more so than that. Like, it's just kind of, we're in that cycle of it. So, well, I'll ask here now about research projects. I know that your work, like you've shared, is so rooted in schools. Has there been any projects that really have stuck out with you? It could be current or past, or any ones that you're like, wow, either gained some new insight, or just left you thinking, you know, I think we need to do this more or less. And I also love, I'm just going to give you a little plug. I love reading your work. I mean,
it's so
based in schools. And I think sometimes in our work, we're so away from that. And I love that you are able to so expertly navigate that theory to practice. And it's wonderful. So.
Well, the first thing that came to mind, and I appreciate you saying that, the first thing that came to mind was learning about formative experiments with Dave Rankin and saying, like, this is a cool thing. I've never thought about this, and trying it out and getting permission to do a formative experiment, a design study with a school with 40% of its students homeless and all students living in poverty and being beat up in the news. And, you know, you're not making your progress. You're not making adequate yearly progress at the time it was called. And figuring out alongside of this group of highly dedicated teachers, what it would take. And to do this formative experiment and document over a 2-year period. And then, so we started in the spring, so they didn't have test results. We did the next year and they made progress. Now, they didn't make all the way to proficiency, but a year and 3 months later, when the first round of testing happened, they had made progress. And the celebrations in this community and the pride. And the next year they made even more progress, and they made AYP the second year. They made their target that year for the state that they were in. And just watching that you could take study, research, and keep adapting it until you got it right, rather than saying, I have something I'm going to study. We're going to make you do this to see, you know, fidelity to it. There's reasons for those studies. But just the experience of being able to design it and modify it and modify it and modify it and modify it till it got right and the teachers owned it, it was an incredible experience to watch that process unfold. And so I'm really proud of the articles that came out from that design experiment, design study, because it was super collaborative with people that really cared about it.
That's wonderful. Well, I love that you, once again, it's rooted in schools, it's working alongside teachers and students, and I think that has made such a big impact. How about your decisions about your career? So when you, what was that like to dis, were you, did you make that decision to become a principal? I'm so fascinated by that because I just think that is such a fascinating journey as in academia. I mean, I don't know if we're, at least, you know, I don't know if we're schooled or, you know, we come up thinking that we
we don't
do that.
We're not,
and I
right.
love that. I think it's so necessary.
So reflecting back, so I worked in the school system for a long time. I ended up going back to school and getting a doctoral degree, not thinking I was going to be a professor. I was going to go into like curriculum or district office or something like that. And I ended up being recruited to go. So I finished my doctoral degree. And my professors are saying, you've got to apply. You should be in the university. You should be doing this. And so I put some applications out and I would leave San Diego and like go to these applications and or these interviews. And I'm like, I don't want to live there. I was born and raised in San Diego. I'm a third generation San Diego. And my grandparents were here. My mom and dad are here. I don't want to go anywhere. I want to stay in San Diego. So so I didn't think anything of it. And then eventually San Diego State posted a job and I'm okay, I'll apply for it. And I worked there for 2 years as a tenure track assistant professor. And I did not like it. I was teaching all these classes. I was in my office a lot because that's where you're supposed to be. I did not enjoy it. And so I went to meet with the dean. And I told the dean, who was a former superintendent, who was assistant commissioner of state education, so very grounded and practical. And I went to the dean and said, I am not loving this. I love my classes. I would love to keep teaching classes, but I need to be where it really is. And at the time, San Diego State was negotiating a grant, $18 million gift. And the donor wanted the educational equivalent of a teaching hospital.
Wow.
And so he had a, his Saul Price had a vision that to improve education, faculty in schools of ed had to be like faculties in schools of medicine, where you practiced and you did your research, but you practiced, you still practiced. And you know, our teaching loads are really high. There's all kinds of reasons why this is difficult that I don't want to diminish. However, he gave this large gift and the collaborative was called the collaborative. It was part of San Diego Unified and San Diego State collaborative agreement to create a teaching hospital equivalent in education. And I was released from part of my teaching responsibility at the university to work on this project. They had 5,300 kids, 450 teachers in this area of San Diego. And I got to teach. I got to co-teach. I got to write. I got to sit in leadership meetings. And that's when I said, well, I've been a teacher. I can write about being a teacher. I understand that. I'm not perfect at it, but I get better all the time. But I've never been a leader. And I really want to understand this role because I worked with three amazing leaders, very different personalities, but three amazing leaders, elementary, middle, high. This is a whole feeder pattern that we had. And so I wanted to do it. And so when that project was sunsetting and there was a transition of leadership, we decided to go small. And say a small learning community, Gates money kind of thing, and create a small school. Well, it was too small to afford a principal because there was only 180 kids when we started. So I'll do it. So I was the co-director, co-principal. So I still had grant money to buy out part of my time. So then I started thinking about leadership and literacy, leadership and curriculum. How do people in that role support the teaching and learning process? So that's how it all started. And I don't think I would still be at San Diego State if it wasn't for that gift from Saul Price. I think I probably would have gone to work for the school district or something like that. But the job, the role that I've created where I am a faculty member, I teach classes in the College of Ed, and I'm immersed in a school every day is very rewarding.
That's
and
wonderful.
It's very much around. It's a match for me that is ideal. So I get to be around students and their teachers, and I get to be around people who want to become teachers and leaders.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's like, it sounds like a dream job.
I love it.
I love it. It sounds amazing. So any suggestions you think and insights for listeners, so faculty, teachers, policymakers, you know, what's your current view or advice to the field? What are some thinking that you're thinking about?
I guess people, we need to rebuild the efficacy, the people's efficacy, leaders and teachers. You're doing amazing jobs. Take some credit for it. And when students don't learn, make some changes and revisions to increase the likelihood they learn, but realize we're having an effect. And the press, the negative stuff that's being said, we have to have a little bit of a shield from it and say, I know what's happening. I watch learning occur on a daily basis. I watch young people grow and develop. And they do so in a large part because of what I did, whether I created a school or created a classroom. And I think we have to regain, and I don't want to diminish the work we have to do politically and socially, but boy, we have to help ourselves. We have to protect ourselves because the narrative is negative. And we have to change that and start the saying, like, we're really good at what we do. We're really, really good at what we do.
How do you think we could do that? I mean, do you think it's, you know, what do you think? How could we?
I think we need to say to each other, we need to get those little wins. These kids did this. That was because of you. I feel like we have disconnected the effort and the impact or outcome because we got beat up all the time and we've accepted the narrative rather than saying, look, I watched you do this lesson and look what happened a day later. Look at where your kids are now. And if we could all do that for each other and create that community of care of, we do great work. This is a hard job. I mean, part of the narrative is anybody could be a teacher, and I challenge anybody to be a teacher. It is a hard, hard job. It's a rewarding job. It's an amazing job, but it's a hard job. And we need to take a little bit, we need to rebuild our sense of efficacy. I think that's like my mission right now.
Yeah.
Is rebuilding the belief, the knowledge that when we do things, when we put forth work, we design a lesson, we grade students' papers, we're having an impact on their learners. And that's on us.
Yeah, I love that. So let me ask you another question. How about, what do you view as important questions that your work has led to? That's a hard question.
It is. So I still think a lot about the instructional support. So we adopted the phrase gradual rates of responsibility. We have our interpretation of it, but how do we enact learning experiences that build students' competence and confidence? I'm still working through that. I've been working on gradual release since 1997 when we did our very first version of that. And I'm still working through, like, how do we create those learning experiences for students? That's a big part of my work. I still, in the world of literacy, I still think we struggle with a strong literacy instructional framework. We're pretty clear on what it takes to develop literacy. I mean, we know whether you talk about strands or whatever, we know this. Where we are as a profession right now is, how do we enact this in a classroom? How do we ensure that students develop all that knowledge? Like, we're working on an adolescent literacy model right now, because, you know, there are a lot of models out there of how you explain reading development in elementary. There's lots of them, you know, the reading rope, a ladder. I mean, there's all kinds of them. We don't really have a model for adolescents. And so with a group of colleagues, we're, you know, testing this perception of, like, what is it? What would be in a model that explains to a teacher, this is how literacy continues to develop after they're in grade 5 or 6? So that's the continual question on my mind. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that I think about a lot.
I love that. And I think that that's such an important component of what we need right now, because the narrative about how kids aren't reading, what happens to them when they get to be in middle and high school, and also, you know, we hear a lot of attention around the science of reading, but that's typically an early elementary issue, right? And so what are those foundational skills that adolescents need, and how do we scaffold that? And then I love that you're working on that, and that's connecting to the framework, so we can look for that. And don't you feel like your pieces all connect toward that? I mean, don't you feel like it's
Yeah. But I want to say, like we have all these visuals out there for elementary reading, whether it's a rope or ladders, and there's all kinds of good ones. We don't have that for adolescents. And I worry that we take some of the early childhood, early literacy things, and then we force fit adolescents and say, but if you know adolescents, what would a literacy model look like?
What do you think is just a key component that you think? I mean, that's a big one.
So right now, to kind of foreshadow this, we're using like a battery and it has a plug, and the plug is self-efficacy. The battery is filled with background knowledge. And then right now we're saying, this is tentative because this is today. We're saying word recognition, word knowledge, sentence fluency, and language comprehension. So we go to recognizing words, ascribing meaning to those words, putting those words in longer pieces of connected text, and then mobilizing your language comprehension to move in. So that would be inferencing and reference and all those things. So we're playing around with this, testing the model and seeing,
That's exciting.
and asking experts for reviews on it to see if we've missed anything. Looking at my team's doing a huge scan of literature to see in adolescents, have we missed anything? So it's kind of intriguing right now of like,
That's
how do
exciting.
you explain this?
I like that. And is that connected to the co-teaching work that you're doing with the co-leadership? Oh, that sounds like a dream. It sounds so wonderful. Well, I love talking with you, Doug. I mean, I could probably talk forever with you because you've such
I
interesting
appreciate that.
perspective, and you're just really such a hero. And
Oh.
but anything else you want to add?
No, I think I really appreciate the conversation. I hope people found some value in our time together because I certainly did. I enjoyed the conversation and you're allowing me to kind of reflect and think about what's going on with me and where to next and things like that.
Well, thank you, Doug. It's so great to talk with you.